ranging from low-tech to cutting-edge high-technology type products, bandages, syringes, scanners, up to heart stents, MRI machines, CAT scanners, and internationally includes approximately 500 different types of technologies. They're used by healthcare professionals, by therapists, and patients themselves every day. And essentially, these products enable people to live healthier and more productive lives. Okay, I think I need to start by stating that SAHMED supports all initiatives aimed at securing better health outcomes through the implementation of quality initiatives such as that of the Office of the Health Standards Compliance. Our primary concern, though, with regard to the amendment bill relates to the norms and standards that are to be enforced by the OHSC on health establishments. We are concerned that these norms and standards may apply to medical devices that are used in such health establishments. We acknowledge that there must be norms and standards set for the use of medical devices, but we contend that these should be governed by or done through a regulatory framework already in existence in terms of amendments to the Medicines and Related Substances Act No. 101 of 1965. And the Amendment Act No. 72 of 2008. We're concerned with the possibility that if the OHSC sets norms and standards applicable to medical devices, there could be inadvertent overlaps or duplication with that of legislation currently applicable to medical devices, so Act 101 and Act 72 as mentioned. A particular clause that we are concerned with in the amendment bill is Clause 79.1F, which we feel is too general in its phrasing, i.e. that the office must recommend quality assurance and quality management systems in the health sector. And the use of the word health sector implies that the mandate of the OHSC extends beyond health institutions to actual health systems, and this is maybe inclusive of medical devices. So, sorry, I'm just referring to my notes. Internationally, medical device manufacturers and local responsible parties. You know, in South Africa, most medical devices are imported, so we don't often have the manufacturer present in South Africa, so it would be an agent or a supplier. But these parties are responsible for the safety and performance of medical devices. In addition, the manufacturer or the importer is responsible to ensure that the users of the medical device is sufficiently informed and or trained to use the device successfully. Thereafter, the responsibility of safety and effectiveness shifts to the health establishment and the healthcare professional to ensure appropriate use, proper maintenance, proper processes of supply chain management, etc. So quality management and quality assurance, as is mentioned in the proposed amendment in the form of Section 79F in the bill, appear, but the standards employed and the responsibilities and implications can be very different depending on the context. So care, therefore, needs to be taken to ensure that general statements, such as those containing general phrases, could have different meanings in different contexts, and we request that this be clarified in the legislation so as to prevent application to the wrong situations. We also have a concern over the independence of the Office of Health Standards Compliance, although independence is mentioned in the memo, it is not mentioned in the bill and therefore not guaranteed. The Office of the Health Standards Compliance seems to be strongly linked to the Office of the Honourable Minister of Health, both on reporting to Parliament and in the work of the Ombud, who would have to make recommendations to be implemented by the CEO or the Minister. The fact that the Minister will prescribe standards without any mechanisms for public or expert input is a concern. If we look at a current document that's been released by the Office of Health Standards Compliance in 2011, which is on the core standards for health facilities, it would already appear that the Office for Health Standards Compliance has set some norms and standards relating to patient safety and the so-called support services, which includes aspects implying or directly relating to medical devices and equipment. It has to be very clear, therefore, in the legislation as to what where the duties of manufacturers end and where the duties of health establishments begin. And I refer now to that document and some of the subdomains that relate specifically to medical devices and medical equipment. And if I may, I'd like to just focus on two in particular where, you know, these grey areas exist in terms of practical considerations. If you look at the safety of medical equipment and its effectiveness, which is referred to in subdomain 3.4 of these national core standards, the safety of medical equipment is a regulatory requirement, and it will be governed by means of medical device regulations. However, the safe use of devices would be a function of training or instructions provided by the manufacturer. But there is also a duty on the user and the facility to ensure the correct use of those devices. Paragraph 3.4.2 does refer to training in correct use, but it doesn't delineate the responsibility in this regard. Paragraph 3.4.3 is again within the domain of the health establishment, i.e. to ensure maintenance. But in reality, in certain aspects, the duty to ensure the supply of spare parts may lie with the manufacturer or the responsible agent. If we look at sterilization under subdomain 3.4, sterilization that decontamination and sterilization services are available and effective is referred to. But in practice, currently many manufacturers or importers actually undertake that task themselves in order to ensure that its equipment are not implicated in adverse events or as a result of lack of facilities or trained staff in facilities. So this duty should rightly rest with the health establishment, but often that is not the case in practical terms. So in essence, what is our proposal? We're proposing that all standards that may be published by the office must be done in a draft format prior to its finalization, so that the practicalities in relation to compliance and responsibility, as well as conflicts with existing obligations or potential conflicts, can be addressed timeously. We also propose that the Office of Health Standards Compliance publishes the standards and not the Honourable Minister of Health, who might be regarded as not being independent insofar as his or her oversight over and responsibility for all health establishments is concerned. The Office of Health Standards Compliance cannot certify entities based on standards that are set by the ultimate head, i.e. the Minister of Health, of such entities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tanya. Members, that is the presentation. It's not particularly different from the others. But I think the main thing is about the standards, that if they could be published before. Are there any questions of clarity to Tanya? You think it's been straightforward? Okay, Tanya, you're lucky. There's nobody, everything is clear. We're going to be checking this and we're going to be looking at them once again.
Thank you. Thank you for the time and opportunity.
Always be in contact with you if there's anything that you want to contact you about. Thank you very much. Go to the next one. I'm not sure whether they are here already. Okay. We've got South African Private Practitioners Forum. Private practitioners. Are you ready, Doc? I suppose that you're a doctor.
Sorry?
I suppose that you're a doctor.
I'm a doctor.
Yeah. Okay, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. We have got two patients here. We couldn't give them sick leaves. We couldn't give them sick leaves because we wanted them to be here. So you can handle them while you're here. One of them is sitting next to me.
Okay.
She says she's got tonsillitis. She diagnosed
it. Well,
the other one is sitting that side.
She's the right sex, but her illness is in the wrong part of her body. I'm a gynecologist.
Have you been here? You know, do we have...
This is my first visit to this committee. And I'd just like to thank the Honourable Committee and yourself for inviting us to present to you on this important issue. To start, just to tell you who is the South African Private Practitioners Forum. We are an independent voluntary association of private specialists. We are a fairly new organization. Essentially, we represent clinical specialists as opposed to the more high-tech specialists such as radiology and pathology and anesthetics. And I know that they are doing separate presentations to you. So we represent surgeons and physicians and pediatricians and these sort of people, psychiatrists and so on. We have a membership in excess of 2,500 paid-up members. We were established fairly recently in 2008 as a non-profit organization, governed by a board of directors, who are nominated by members and accountable to the members. And I'm the CEO appointed by the board. That's just by way of introduction so that the committee understands where we're coming from. In accordance with the Constitution's entrenchment of healthcare as a fundamental human right and our ethical responsibilities and obligations as members of the medical profession, the South African Private Practitioners Forum is committed to progressively act to improve access to healthcare for all South Africans. And therefore, we welcome this opportunity to participate in this debate this afternoon. We believe that specialists play a vital role in any healthcare system, and accordingly, it's imperative that the role of specialists should be considered in the context of establishing an entity to perform independent oversight on healthcare. In general principles, we accept the aim of the National Health Amendment Bill to establish the Office of Health Systems Compliance, Standards Compliance, by amending the National Health Act of 2003. But we do have a number of concerns. In essence, the concerns are in four areas, and I understand that many presentations have already highlighted the issue of independence. I'll talk very briefly about our concerns about the independence of the entity itself, the reporting lines that are envisaged, the actual determining of norms and standards, the independence of that process, and the role of the Umbert and his independence. In addition to that, we have concerns around the actual establishment of norms and standards in the industry, funding of the body, and lastly, the accreditation of specialists. And I'll just run through these very, very briefly, starting with the issue of independence. The establishment of the Office of Health Standards Compliance itself, we believe, should be preferably by separate statute. It shouldn't be an entity established within the Department of Health. And in fact, if one refers to the document on national core standards of health establishments that were approved by the National Health Council in 2010, it actually states in that document that in the future an independent national inspector will carry out inspections. And we believe this body must be independent in the true sense of the word. And the document as it stands is somewhat confusing on this issue. Again, we believe this entity should report directly to Parliament rather than through the Minister of Health. And the main reason for saying this is we are concerned that the minister is also a supplier of service in the sense that he is responsible for the provision of services by the public service. Therefore one should separate those two roles. In terms of determining norms and standards, the document states that the minister is not obliged to consult, nor is he bound by any recommendations of the Office of Health Standards Compliance. And as I said, as a provider of services itself, the Department of Health and the Minister should have no influence on the setting of these norms and standards. The Ombud should also be independent from the office, with its own separate office, and should, in our view, be able to dispose of complaints without dependence on first providing a report to the CEO. And if the CEO is unhappy with the report or for whatever reason doesn't act on that report, to go to the minister. The Ombud should be able to report directly and deal with the issues directly. With regard to norms and standards, I'm not sure what's happening here. There are already norms and standards in the industry, both in terms of current legislation, ethical rules of the Health Professions Council, for example, and there are a myriad guidelines and protocols in use in terms of providing clinical care and treatment. And we are concerned that one should avoid any potential conflict between the setting of these norms and standards and those that are currently in existence. And these clinical standards, we believe, have to be set by professionals working in their specific fields because they understand what those standards should be better than anyone else. Peer review, by its very name, should be done by peers, and internationally, controlling bodies are independent of government organizations. And I mention the example of the National Institute of Clinical Excellence in the UK as an example. So I believe it's critically important that the profession be consulted in establishing clinical norms and standards for use in a future national health environment. We are also concerned with respect to funding, that it's our understanding in our reading of the bill that 50% of the funding will be provided for by fees for services rendered. But nowhere in the document are fees or services rendered actually defined, and therefore it is difficult or impossible, in fact, to comment on the impact that these fees will have on the health establishments and private practitioners, and therefore clearly further and greater clarification must be provided with respect to funding. With regard to the accreditation of specialists, in the briefing session to this Honourable Committee, the Deputy Minister on the 14th of February stated that a regulatory framework with accreditation of institutions was necessary to ultimately ensure mandatory compliance and to protect the public. Whereas we basically agree with the fundamental principles that are being referred to here, with respect to the profession, we do not believe that it is necessary to provide further accreditation of individual doctors, because doctors already are, they have their professional qualifications on the one hand, and they are registered with a statutory body, the Health Professions Council, and already have to comply with stringent professional requirements. So an additional layer of accreditation, in our view, would be a duplication of this function and would be both imprudent and inappropriate use of scarce resources. In my reading of the debate that took place on the 14th of February, the Minister and the Deputy Minister raised the issue of private sector pricing. Now, I'm appreciative that it's not directly a part of this discussion, but because it was raised on the 14th, I thought it would be useful perhaps just to provide a few comments from the profession. So if the chairman will allow me, I would like to just, there are about 5 points that I just want to, and I think the point I'm trying to make, the most important point, is I think we need to be objective about the realities of private sector pricing. And there's been a lot in the press recently about the private sector being extremely expensive, and the private sector has been referred to by the minister himself as a monster. And I think these are perhaps unfair generalizations. And so I don't want to get engage in a debate here, but I'd just like to make a few points that I think the committee perhaps needs to consider, because clearly this will be an important debate going forward. So I think it's probably not generally appreciated that the medical scheme rate has declined in real terms over the past 40 years. To a third of what it was 40 years ago. And if you look back to 1970, the medical scheme rate for each unit of service paid 48 cents. Now, if you take that 48 cents and you multiply it by the inflation rate each year to the current date, you get to a figure that should be about 25 rand. But in fact, for procedures, the medical aid rate currently is paying 8 rand 80. So there's been a fairly devastating effect, a devaluing effect of the medical aid rate because of the inroads of inflation. And I think that needs to be considered in the context of why doctors often have to charge more than the medical aid rates are prepared to reimburse. The other thing is, I don't know whether people realize, but the South African private sector is more cost-effective than the majority of international public health sectors. For example, the cost, the spend in the South African private sector is about 9,000 per member per month. compare that with the UK, it's about 24,000, and another country like New Zealand is about 23,500. So, and they are both public health services. So, and yet South Africa is in the fortunate position of having many thousands of people who visit this country as medical tourists, because they're attracted here by the low cost of private health care and the superb service. And I am very proud to be a member of that of the South African Private Health Service. The first point that I made is also borne out by the formula developed by the Council for Medical Schemes for the National Health Reference Price Process, and that reveals as well, through a totally different mechanism, that the current scheme benefit rates are about a third of what calculations suggest they should be. And I don't want to go into the details here, but that information is readily available should any member of the committee wish to discuss that with me. Another factor that is affecting inflation in terms of medical benefits and medical scheme membership premiums is that worldwide there is a medical CPI which runs generally at about 3% higher than national inflation rates. And this, the medical profession and everybody involved in the provision of healthcare can do very little about, because we're talking about the imported costs of technology and drugs and so on and so forth, which are generally about 3% higher and increasing it at a rate of about 3% per year higher than the national inflation rate. Another point that has been commonly reported on is that the two major drivers of private healthcare costs are those of hospitals and specialists. And I just want to make the point that if you read the Council for Medical Schemes annual reports, the registrar's reports, amounts paid out to specialists are lumped together. So not only clinical specialists, but pathologists and radiologists get lumped as a single amount. And that amount includes the cost of providing the cost of equipment, material, and staff salaries. So that amount that is paid out to specialists isn't the income earned by specialists per se. It goes to covering a very big business entity itself. And the last point, and this particularly affects me as an obstetrician, and it is causing a serious crisis in the provision of maternity care in this country, is that the costs of malpractice insurance have increased over the last 15 years by about 650%, whereas the procedure fees, in other words, fees for delivery in that same period, have gone up about 88%. 15 years ago, I was paying about 3,000 Rand a year for insurance. This year, I'm paying more than 250,000 Rand. And if I can't cover those costs, I can't provide that service. And unfortunately, many, many obstetricians are facing that dilemma. Do they continue to provide the service, or do they pull out? And a lot of them are not providing the service any longer. So, and this is a problem that is facing the public service just as much as the private. So there are real issues around costs that need to be considered in the future going forward. Let me just get rid of this again. So, in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, we support the establishment of this office, but we believe it must be independent in the true sense of the word. We believe that accreditation procedures should not be duplicated, and certainly with reference to the profession, there are adequate accreditation procedures already in place. We believe that the profession should be consulted with respect to the setting of clinical norms and standards. We welcome the opportunity to participate in this process, and the South African Private Practitioners Forum remains committed to promoting access to quality healthcare for all South Africans. Thank you.
Thank you, Doc. You didn't tell us what you are, Doctor who?
Dr. Chris Archer.
Thank you very much. I allowed you to talk about other things that are beyond.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Because we need that information. We just need to know what's happening. Members, that is the presentation from private practitioners. I think they mentioned exactly what they think that must be there in the bill, and I don't think there's anything that is we're doubting in what they're saying. But do you want any to questions of clarity? Do you have any questions of clarity? Okay. I see the two hands. Okay. Honorable Robinson.
Thank you, Chair. It's actually not clarity about the presentation. I thank you for that. I think it was clear, and it's very obvious that most people are coming up with the same point. So I think we've got some clear guidelines when we work through the line-by-line legislation. But just a comment you made as an aside, I'd just like to know, you mentioned, for example, that the insurance for against malpractice has gone up to $250,000 as opposed to $3,000? Yes. Could you just explain why that is now? I know there's a tremendous problem within the rural areas and so on with maternal mortality and problems arising in pregnancies and so on, but I wasn't aware of this being a problem in, say, urban areas. So I don't know if there's a connection. I'm just interested in that. Thank you.
There are simple questions for you, but for me they might not be. You're saying that the norms and standards must be prescribed by the professionals. By professionals, you mean who in this instance? You mean the people that are responsible for drafting this law, or the unit or the department responsible for drafting the law, or by professionals? And then accreditation, there should be no duplication of accreditation. Can you just clarify that for me? Because I think, I leave it at that and not give what I think. Thanks.
Thank you. Maybe before you come in, I need to join your association. If you could give me the details, I'm going to tell. There's something that was on TV yesterday, which was very interesting. They were talking about how patients are mismanaged by doctors. And there was one patient who had a VVS, and the gynecologist, they kept on showing his nameplate, but he never came on TV to say what was happening. But I think this goes on with... maybe we're becoming enemies, the doctors are becoming enemies, or the lawyers are becoming enemies of doctors. So there's an escalation of litigation of doctors. There might be many reasons for that. Part of, probably some of the reasons that people are becoming aware of their rights. That this is my right, and this is... But probably there might be other reasons why the lawyers have become interested in what's happening. So this escalation... is probably something, and the people that have hit so hard are the gynecologists. I think they're the ones that have been high on the list. Probably they're going to be followed by surgeons, but those who do the operations. I think the last one will be the physicians. The physicians will never get there, because if I give somebody Ultomate and they develop hepatitis, you can argue that it's not the Ultomate that causes hepatitis, it's probably a virus that causes it. So the physicians probably are lucky. I'm trying to say that probably that. And it was very interesting that I saw on TV, because it was a patient with VVS that was having a problem. Maybe you can come in and answer some of the questions, including the accreditation.
Just to try and answer, I think it's a difficult question to answer in just a couple of minutes. But there are a number of factors. I mean, it's not simply a South African phenomenon. It's a worldwide problem. But I think patients are becoming more aware of their rights. They're becoming more sophisticated. I think there's an unfair expectation that the medical profession can perform miracles, and that, you know, ultimately everybody dies and there's nothing that we can do about that. But there's an expectation that if you go to the doctor, you're going to get better. And that definitely doesn't always happen. And sometimes the ball bounces badly, and it's not because of anything that the doctor has done that's wrong. Unfortunately, in the litigious environment, the only people who are currently insured is the profession. So when a problem has arisen and there is a need for funding, I mean, say a child is born brain damaged. Now, that brain damage may have preceded the delivery of the child. And in fact, the evidence today shows that in most cases of patients with cerebral palsy, the damage occurs to the child's brain before delivery. But that child needs care. Now, who's going to pay for it? The medical aides won't. And the parents can't. The state doesn't have the money. So they look to the insurers, and the only people who are insured are is the profession. And in order for them to gain access to those funds, they have to prove negligence and liability on the part of the profession. So that's one of the factors. Another factor that certainly ratcheted things up here has been the introduction of the contingency sort of idea that lawyers will take on cases and will, without charging a fee, but their fee will be contingent on them winning the case. And that has also led to fairly large claims being lodged. A third factor has been the problems around the Road Accident Fund. And the lawyers that were working in that environment have now, because there is that fund is essentially bankrupt, and the payouts are restricted, the lawyers have focused, and you can hear this every day on the radio, there are lawyers advertising their services to deal with, you know, patients who feel they may have been aggrieved. So there's a lot of additional pressure, and in fact you can see that although the number of claims hasn't changed dramatically, the quantum of claims has ratcheted it up very, very dramatically. So there may have been a 10% increase of claims over the last 3 or 4 years, but the quantum of claims has gone up about 300 or 400%. So, and you know, the size of the medical profession in this country is relatively small, and yet they are the people who are funding all of this money. So, and that's why the premiums are escalating at a rate far greater than the inflation rate. And it really is creating a major problem. So that's, if I can leave the answer to that question. The second question relates to the issue of norms and standards. And I think what I was referring to there when I talked about professionals, I'm talking about medical professionals, and I'm talking specifically with reference to clinical issues. So the establishment of norms and standards. In other words, treatment and management protocols of disease entities. These should be established by medical professionals. I'm not talking about other norms and standards in terms of things like cleanliness and patient safety in the hospitals and so on and so forth. And the third item was around the issue of accreditation. Now, what we're saying is there is a body that accredits doctors at the moment. You can't practice as a doctor in South Africa without being registered with the Health Professions Council. And you cannot be registered with the Health Professions Council without first proving your competency by way of examination. So that's what I'm referring to there. So I don't think it's necessary to add a further layer for locally trained graduates, certainly, of accrediting trained doctors in this country to work in, say, a national health environment. Does that satisfy your...
Thank you very much. Remember that I don't think there are any other clarity questions. Maybe we should step off. I think there's something that says on the bill that the CEO could get some outside people who are competent from outside, and I suspect that, that includes the doctors. If you want to put on standards for the doctors, we have to get for the gynecologist, you have to get gynecologists to say. So I think it is there, it is somewhere there. But in any case, all what you have said, we're going to take into consideration when we look at the bill again.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you very much, Doc. We wish you well in your litigation and what goes on in Kahako. I think it's the headache of the DG too, the litigations that are going on with the gynecologists. It's not only for you. The next presenter, or P, is it? Piazza. I'm not sure whether they are around or... Okay. We've got a special seat here for you. Do you want to know who are these members of Parliament? Or have you been here before?
I have not been here before.
Oh, yeah, okay. I will ask them to introduce themselves to you.
Okay.
So that you know, and then after that, you introduce yourself
okay.
to us and tell us, then you may go to your presentation. Message, I'll start with you. If you the lady doesn't know the members of Parliament, so she wants to know who are these people that she's going to be presenting to. We'll start with you first.
My name is Magaleng Patricia Kopani. I'm from the Free State Province. Thank you.
I'm Denise Robinson. I'm from the Western Cape, and I'm a member of the Health Portfolio Committee.
I'm Sherilyn Dudley, and a member of this committee.
Mulebogeng Christina Duve, member of the committee.
Afternoon, I'm Tandwe Kenny, member of this committee from Eastern Cape.
Okay, good afternoon. I'm Beatrice Ngom. Thank you.
You can see we're led by Women's League. Okay, you can tell us who you are.
Good afternoon, Chairperson and Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee. My name is Kirti Nasai, and I am representing the Pharmaceutical Industry Association of South Africa. Firstly, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to present to you this afternoon on the PIASA position on this National Health Amendment Bill. Firstly, I'd like to introduce our association to you. PIASA stands for Pharmaceutical Industry Association of South Africa. We are the longest established trade association in South Africa representing pharmaceutical companies. Our membership consists of 18 multinational as well as local companies operating in the country, and we currently supply more than 25% of medicines into the public and private sectors. Recently, we conducted a survey to look at the public sector supply, and across 15 companies, we supply 158 products, most of which are used for the treatment of non-communicable diseases. The next slide shows a graph in terms of the EDL, so that's the essential drugs list component of that supply, and this was part of our NHI submission. The disease areas that we specifically looked at in the survey was around the priority areas of non-communicable diseases, HIV, TB, and maternal and child health. Overall, our position is that we fully support the implementation of a structure and standards aimed at ensuring quality of care, which will ultimately protect patients, whilst optimizing compliance to standards by all stakeholders. And that is really going to be the focus of my presentation this afternoon. As you are aware, there is a national core standards document which makes reference to a national inspectorate, the Office of Health Standards Compliance, that will carry out inspections to determine the degree of compliance and issue public reports on their findings. But inspection and enforcement mechanisms already exist for medicines, and therefore there may be areas of overlap between the Office of Health Standards Compliance and other regulators. I'd like to then show you what might seem like... Okay, here we go. I'd like to share with you this diagram, which on the surface looks very complex, and I'm sharing this with you this afternoon to illustrate the complexity of the medicine value chain. And so the top darker blocks show the development process from development to destruction of a medicine. And underneath those, you will see examples of the various controls that already exist in this medicine value chain. So the message from this slide is really that systems and skills already exist to monitor compliance across the value chain managed by other regulatory bodies such as the Medicine Control Council and the South African Pharmacy Council. I'd like to then take you to some examples of areas of overlap that could potentially be problematic from an implementation perspective. The first one relates to Domain 1, which talks about patient rights. So if we refer to the core standards document, it talks about access to information for patients. In particular, that patients should be given information that they need regarding their treatment, their care after discharge, and their participation in research where relevant. On the right-hand side, you will see that there are current measures in place to manage some of these issues already. So for instance, if we look at the Medicines Act, there is a provision made for package inserts, which are the leaflets that you find in medicine packaging, and those are managed by the regulations to the Medicines Act. And then the content of those package inserts are also reviewed and approved by the Medicine Control Council. In terms of participation in research, the good clinical practice requirements require informed consent from clinical trial participants, and there's also a robust process in place for clinical trial approval, both by the Medicine Control Council as well as various ethics committees, to ensure that research is conducted in an ethical manner. Then we also have other provisions, for instance, in the Consumer Protection Act, which requires plain language communication to consumers, as well as the ethical rules for healthcare professionals and the National Health Act Chapter 2. A second area that we've identified as an area of overlap is around patient safety, clinical governance, and clinical care. So again, if we refer to the core standards document under 2.5, it talks about adverse events, and adverse events or patient safety incidents to be promptly identified and managed to minimize patient harm and suffering, as well as adverse events being routinely analyzed and managed to prevent recurrence. Again, here, the Medicine Control Council has a guideline that needs to be complied with regarding adverse event reporting. So healthcare professionals and manufacturers of medicines need to report adverse events within specified time frames in a specified format. The next area is around destruction of medicines. Here, the bill refers to the fact that environmental health inspectors will also fall under the Office of Health Standards Compliance. This then overlaps with the Medicine Control Council and Pharmacy Council inspectors, which are already in place. And again, the Medicine Control Council has a specific guideline specifying the processes and requirements for medicine destruction. So these are just some of the areas that we've identified, and I've used these as examples to illustrate the areas of overlap, which will create complexity if not dealt with in terms of the stakeholders that need to be compliant with these requirements. Our next point is around the independence and accountability of the CEO and the Ombuds, and I think that that has been well covered in other presentations. And we would like to make a recommendation that there be direct accountability of the Office of Health Standards Compliance to Parliament and real independence for the Ombud to make decisions. The next slide focuses on clauses 78, 82, and 89, which talk about monitoring versus enforcement. So there are some areas, for instance, with Clause 78 that talks about monitoring of compliance, whereas 82 and 89 talk about offences and penalties that will be applicable should those norms and standards not be complied with. Again, here currently for medicines, there are provisions for norms and standards, as illustrated previously. For monitoring compliance, inspections, and enforcement, which exist under the Medicine Act as well as the Pharmacy Act for all in the supply chain. The next slide focuses on the delegation, cooperation, and harmonization of the functions of the Office of Health Standards Compliance. And here we would like to propose that standard setting, compliance, and enforcement within powers of the MCC as well as the Pharmacy Council be excluded from these provisions, and where necessary that these bodies are called upon to evaluate suspected non-compliance with such standards. Again, here the message is around the fact that enforcement mechanisms, inspection mechanisms, etc., already exist and are enforced by these regulatory bodies. The existing and known overlapping jurisdictions on the standard setting are not really dealt with in the bill, and it is recommended that this be looked at. With regards to inspections and quality assurance, we've highlighted two clauses there, the inspection and certification of health establishments, and the recommendation of quality assurance and management systems for the National Health System to the Minister for approval. Medicines in particular are registered on the basis of safety, efficacy and quality by the Medicines Control Council. This includes provisions for inspections to ensure the quality of the medicines through good manufacturing practice requirements. There are also further provisions made for medicine recalls where quality issues are identified. The South African Pharmacy Council and Medicine Control Council are responsible for inspection of pharmacies, including manufacturing pharmacies. Specialized skills are required for monitoring and inspection for compliance to standards with medicine standards. Inspectors have to undergo specialized training to conduct these inspections. In conclusion, the medicine value chain is complex and already well regulated. Quality, safety, and efficacy controls already exist across the medicine value chain. We require specialized expert skills as well as intimate knowledge of the operational processes that are required for the inspection purposes. So base qualifications, for instance, are not adequate. Internationally, these requirements have become areas of specialization. So to give an example, just any registered pharmacist, for instance, would not be in a position to conduct a good manufacturing practice inspection. Nor a pharmacy, retail pharmacy inspection for that matter. There is specialized training and skills that are required so that the inspectors know what it is to look out for. It is therefore recommended that areas of overlap between the Office of Health Standards Compliance, Medicines Control Council, and the Pharmacy Council be carefully reviewed in order to avoid duplication and to facilitate adherence to norms and standards to ensure and maintain quality of medicines to protect patients. Finally, I'd like to thank you on behalf of PIASA for this opportunity to present to you, and we look forward to future interactions with this very important committee on health. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I take it that we are Kitty. Thank you very much, Kitty. You are not the only one who didn't tell us what's your name. But it doesn't, even myself, I didn't tell you where am I. I'm Bivin Kokona. I forgot to tell you who is the person that is sitting here. Thank you very much for that presentation. Members, that is the presentation. I think what is coming out very clearly here is that they accept that we must amend the Health Act. But they think that there's going to be an overlap on certain things. But in that overlap, I take it that you would want to see something like a Chapter 9 institution that reports to Parliament. That's what is being said. That this organization must report to Parliament rather than to the Minister. The last one is the same as the private doctors, where they say, if something is going to be done, you must get the experts. I'm very happy because the DG is a pharmacist, so we've got an expert here who's a pharmacist who will tell us what's happening in the medicine. So at least she knows. Okay, members, that's any questions of clarity?
I'm looking at your hand. If there are no questions, they don't have, we don't have to have market here and manual.
Thank you for the presentation. I've only got one question. Yes, there are no numbers in this, but I think under the proposal that is set here, I don't know which page is this. that standard setting compliance and enforcement within powers of MCC and Pharmacy Council be excluded. So my question is that, can you elaborate more? Why do you need exclusion of MCC and Pharmacy Council? Thank you.
Actually, I was going to talk about that one, but to say, seeing that here we're talking about health with respect to hospitals, clinics, and community centers, maybe that is not necessarily very relevant, but it's a point that has been taken. Maybe the regulations will look into that area. And then secondly, out of interest and curiosity, much as you are not boasting, you are just informing us that there are brochures that are given to patients when they are being dispensed medicines. But are you aware that 3/4 of the patients don't read those brochures because they do not know what is written therein? They usually just take it, throw it out, or take the bottle out and throw the box away. So probably maybe you also have got some homework as a pharmacist.
You can go on.
Okay, if I can respond to the first question, why should MCC and the Pharmacy Council be excluded? I think our position is essentially we want to avoid duplication, as well as confusion by those who need to comply. Because at the end of this process, there are companies, individual healthcare professionals, like pharmacists, that will need to comply to these norms and standards. So we do have a robust system in place already. It is well enforced by the Medicine Control Council and the Pharmacy Council. And so we essentially are saying, let's not duplicate what is already working. Also, there is provision made for delegation and harmonization, although we would like to see more detail and clarity in terms of how these will be managed. For the second point in terms of the focus on hospitals and clinics, it is not clear currently as the bill is written, because it does refer to any health establishment. So based on that, we assume that we will, for instance, be included. And so maybe a recommendation there is to provide further clarity on what types of health establishments will be applicable in this context. In terms of the package insert, I agree that patients don't read them. Currently, from a pharmaceutical manufacturer's point of view, companies comply to the regulations to the Medicine Act, which require a package insert to be put into the packaging. But I think here we cannot underestimate the value of the dispensing process and the patient counseling aspect that needs to happen at the point of dispensing between the pharmacist and the patient. I think that is absolutely critical. There are discussions around the plain language requirements on how industry could comply with that. And like I said, those are still under discussion. And then we further have the Consumer Protection Act, which makes provision for plain language communication to consumers. So I think, again, there's a need for harmonization across that legislation so that you are giving plain language information about medicines to the consumer. But again, I reiterate the importance of the counseling aspect at the point of dispensing.
Thank you very much. Members, are you satisfied with your... Okay. Thank you very much. We are going to be taking all your suggestions. Eh? Oh, you had forgotten something?
Something that was said. Maybe I didn't understand it
better. I had the explanation that says they want to be excluded or exempted because their processes are up to scratch. It's giving me like more questions than answers. I'm saying when you submit today and the process continues, you are not going to be part of that, or you don't want to be part of that. I just want to understand what you just said now. It's not a question, it's just out of what the member has asked and the question that you gave. Maybe I misunderstood you.
Essentially what we're saying is that there are robust controls in place which are currently enforced by the Medicine Control Council as well as the Pharmacy Council. And then when we look at the bill, it talks about any health establishment. So it's not clear at this point in time how the ones, the establishments that are already well regulated, how those will be managed by the Office of Health Standards Compliance. So our proposal is to exclude them. And one way to exclude them would be around the provisions made for delegation and harmonization. And this is just to avoid duplication of effort by the Medicine Control Council, the Pharmacy Council, and the Office of Health Standards Compliance.
Thank you. Is that clear now? Okay. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
We will be taking all your deliberations and putting them together, and we're
still going to look at the bill and see what amendments are we going to make. Yeah, thank you very much. Members, we were supposed to be meeting Usama. I don't think they are here. So it says this was the last presentation for today. We are going to be meeting after the constituency period, but we haven't finalized the date when we're going to be meeting for the simple reason that on the 24th of April, we'll be having the EPC's extended public committees. So, and we still have to have a meeting with the department on the strategy, on their strategy. So the thing that we're going to be rushing in making sure that we meet the department on their strategy before the EPCs. So this is why we can't give you a date as to when we're going to. But so we're not going to have summer. Then it takes me to try and summarize what we have had since that day. I think if not all the people that have come here are agreeing that we definitely need to amend the Health Act. They all agree, but they've got some concerns that probably we need to register, and they're going to be registered formally. The first one being that of independence. There's a lot of people that have been complaining, talking about whether how independent is going to be independent. So that independence is one thing that is coming up time and again from them. The other one is duplication. Obviously, we've got to look at all the laws that are pertaining to the quality and the safety of patients, and it's something that we've got to look into. The other part that they're worried about is when they do those inspections, are we going to be calling experts, or are we going to be using anybody that they find which might have a questionable result? There's another part that was mentioned on Tuesday. It was mentioned by one of the laboratory companies, organizations. They talked about the certificate of need, trying to say that probably that certificate of need is something that we don't need to have, but it's something that we've got to look into, and probably something that we definitely have to scrutinize. One of the things that came, which I heard it from for the first time, which was coming from the HASA, is that suggestion that they're suggesting that we should have a separate independent body that deals with pricing. They mentioned it. I didn't hear other people mentioning it, but HASA mentioned it. So with that, we were going to sit down again and look at the bill. As I said, we don't know the date yet, but we are going to be told as the date and when we're going to be looking at it. And we're going to consider all these things that have been said. Because ours was just to listen to them and get clarity. And then when we sit down again, we look at whether are we making the right bill. But one thing that is for sure is that we need to transform the health services, definitely in South Africa. And this is a precursor to the National Health Insurance. So we're not going to move back. We're going to try and see, as long as something that is going to be helping all the South Africans. So thank you very much, members. It's a Friday. I know you were supposed to be in your constituencies or at home, but you decided to stay here until so late. Thank you very much. We don't take it for granted that you're sitting here. I must thank the Department of Health with the leadership of TG. Thank you very much, TG. We know that we didn't want you to say anything. The only person who keeps on getting out of order is Monabis. I think he knows why he keeps on getting out of order. It's because he's a lawyer, now he's talking to a doctor. So he always wants to fight doctors. But we know you were just keeping quiet. We didn't want you to talk. But we know why you're here, and we thank you for being here. Thank you, Monabis. There are no comments, and it doesn't matter. You can be a lawyer, we can fight. But thank you very much for being here. When I've got problems, I'll come to you so that you can help me. When my wife hits me, I'll come to you. Thank you very much. The secretariat and the researcher, thank you very much. You always on our side. Who wants to go? DJ, you must help us with money. Who wants to go to Britain? She wants to go to Britain so that we can go and see. She says we want to go and see how they are handling the Office of Standards. But I know it's not about the Office of Standards. She wants to buy dresses in Britain. That's why she wants to go to Britain. So, but in any case, if you've got money, you can give us so that we can go.
Okay, but DFID has offered to support the committee, so I guess you can go back to DFID.
Oh, no, in fact, you help us so that we get the money from DFID, and if you guys can go, they must put aside the money that is going to buy hairdressers in Britain. Even the community, the Cape Town community, thank you very much. At least you have had a share, but we'll be waiting for your written submission so that we can take it to consider. Thank you very much for coming. Thanks, everybody. I thought there were journalists here, but if they've gone, you can tell them that we're saying thank you to them. Thank you very much, everybody. Let's go and enjoy. It's a weekend. We can go and start drinking alcohol, whatever. Oh, the department is here. They don't want us to drink alcohol. Oh. Still tea outside. Okay. Those who are addicts, they can go and have tea outside. Thank you very much, everybody. Oh.